and welcome to TDF Talks, a fortnightly podcast brought to you by The Design Files, Australia's most popular design blog. I'm your host, Lucy Fagans, and I'm the founder and editor of The Design Files. Today's episode is brought to you by Mercedes Me. On the corner of Collins Street and King Street in Melbourne, Mercedes Me is an architecturally designed cafe, event space and concept store operated by Mercedes-Benz in partnership with Melbourne Coffee King's St. Ali. Throughout June and July, The Design Files has been hosting TDF Talks at Mercedes Me, a conversation series featuring speakers from architecture, design and fashion. This podcast is part of that series. Our conversation with Jeremy McLeod was recorded live at Mercedes Me earlier this month. TDF Talks is an enhanced podcast, which means if you listen using the Overcast or Pocket Casts apps, you will see images and links in your player while you listen. Jeremy McLeod is a successful Melbourne architect with his own award-winning practice, Breathe Architecture. But there's a lot more to Jeremy than just designing beautiful, sustainable houses. In 2007, Jeremy came up with a bold question. Could housing in Australia, and potentially beyond, be more than just a commodity? Could apartments be built to be affordable, environmentally sustainable, and genuinely livable? This question led Jeremy to develop a prototype apartment building in Brunswick called The Commons, and later to develop a housing model called Nightingale Housing. Nightingale Housing is a small independent organisation that empowers Australian architects to develop their own apartment buildings, delivering sustainable, design-led housing that is affordable, long-term livable, and community-centred. It's a pretty utopian idea that multi-residential housing can and should be cheaper and better, and that putting people first and cutting out a few middlemen along the way really can create homes that are socially, financially, and environmentally sustainable. It's what Jeremy calls a triple bottom line approach, and it's making big waves in the Australian housing market. In this inspiring conversation, Jeremy shares how he came up with the Nightingale model, his approach to risk-taking, and what he hopes the future looks like for housing in Australia. Before we get into Nightingale, and there'll be a big focus on Nightingale tonight, but before we get into that, I'm really keen to understand a little more about your background. What drew you to architecture initially and to launching your own practice?
So I guess the context for me is probably the way that I was brought up. My parents were hippies, so I grew up in the 70s and 80s with spray painting shadows on Hiroshima Day on the footpath, going to nuclear disarmament rallies, to environmental rallies. When I was 11, my dad took me to Canberra to pitch a little tent city with some homeless people from Footscray to petition the government to start rebuilding state housing. So I was brought up with this kind of, you know, idea about that we all have a broader social responsibility to the environment and to other human beings. And I think that was the context that led me to study environmental design as my undergrad. So I studied environmental design. I learned about all the technical things, you know, that are required to make a sustainable building and all the things that people have been doing for 2,000 years, like the Romans, you know, with fountains in their courtyards and how to ventilate a building, like the Arabs, you know, 1,500 years ago. And then, you know, all the hippies in the 70s building great sustainable homes. And then somewhere in the 90s, we lost our way. So I graduated and I came to work for Nonda Katsalitis in Melbourne. And the thing that I really liked about Katsalitis was that he just built Melbourne Terrace next to the Victorian Markets. So it's six-story apartments. They've all got their own address with these kind of statues out the front. And they were beautiful homes. And I think that part of the reason that Melbourne Terrace worked really well is that Nonda Katsalitis was the developer himself. He led that project. He kind of, you know, made it happen and brought it to be. So I worked there for 4 years. But my last project with Katsalitis at that time, Fender Katsalitis, was Eureka Tower, slated as, at the time as Australia's tallest residential tower. So I spent 6 weeks working on the car park. And I had an undergrad in environmental design. I'd studied university under some incredible people, really inspiring people that taught me to care about housing and that as architects we could we could be influential in making cities. And after 6 weeks of working on a car park, clad in orange, a Luca Bond, I thought that it was time to go. I started my own practice. And at that time, it was called Breathe Design because I wasn't registered. I was just a graduate architect. We registered, you know, we put our name on the Google machine. And there was six people that were listed as sustainable architects in Melbourne back in 2001. So I was one of six. Google Sustainable Architects Melbourne now, and apparently we're all sustainable. So we must have succeeded. So I started my practice, and then basically we had a very simple policy. It was called Breathe, not because I regretted calling it Breathe immediately after I called it Breathe. Everyone said how pretentious. You know, it would have been much better calling it Jeremy McLeod Architects. Anyway, so I called it Breathe because the idea was that every room would have a window that you could open. It was that simple. You know, this idea about sustainability being quite simple, that, you know, if humans could open a window, they'd be okay. Anyway, I started, you know, Tam, my wife, who's here, kind of, you know, helped me, like the first office that we're in, you know, we'd clean the office on Sundays to pay for our rent there. And then every year we would employ someone new. And Bonnie Herring, like the, you know, you think that the commons is me, it's actually Bonnie Herring, my project architect, standing over there. Stick up your little hand, Bonnie. So Bonnie is the one that brought the commons to be. You know, she's been with me forever. She's a director of Breathe. She's highly introverted, but she is very, very good. And I think that the reason that Breathe is good is not because of me. I have a lot of the same beliefs that my parents had, but Breathe Architecture is actually made up of a group of incredibly talented people. They're all much smarter than me. They're much better architects than me. But I think together we kind of all work together to be, you know, a great organism. But I'm, you know, one of the only extroverts. So that's why everyone thinks that I'm Breathe. But I'm just the talker.
So you launched your own practice in 2001, Breathe Design, which later turned into Breathe Architecture. At the time, did you have any grand plans for the practice or for anything bigger than the practice? Did you imagine what Breathe Architecture might become?
Not at all. Like, you know, as a graduate architect, you know, I wanted to work for a great architect. I was happy to be there. When I started my own practice, you know, I just wanted to design a nice bathroom and detail a good stair like all good graduate architects. You know, I was obsessed about this idea that, you know, I really wanted to work on a beautiful home and design the most beautiful home. I think it wasn't until about 2006 or 2007. So in 2006, John Howard made an announcement that climate change was real. And in 2007, it was the Kevin 07 election when everyone was talking about carbon, everyone was talking about climate change. And it felt palpable that finally everyone understood that, you know, things were changing forever. But up until that point in time, we were working on, you know, houses. But some of our clients, you know, when we had an issue around cost, you know, it was cut the water tank, take out the solar panels, you know, change the pitch of the roof so that it faces west or south instead of north because it'll be cheaper, but leave in the marble in the second bathroom. You know, and so I was incredibly frustrated that those were the projects that I was working on. And so, you know, our industry fetishizes private residential homes. You know, we've got, there's an entire industry that's built around it. I'm not talking about you, Lucy. I'm talking about my industry and what we choose to do, who we choose to work for, and what we choose to spend our time on. And I think for us, we can choose to educate our clients or we can choose to spend our clients' money blindly. And I'm talking about, you know, people coming to us saying, I'd like a sustainable home with six bathrooms, six bedrooms, and I'd like a basement car park with 12 cars. How many people live in your house? Or two? You know, so I don't understand that as a sustainable model. So I think that as a profession, at some point, I think for us it was a very, very slow burn. Like, you know, Bonnie's been with me for a long time and we were doing bars, cafes, single houses and pushing the sustainability agenda, but it wasn't until we got to the Commons in 2007 after working for some property developers and realising that the thing is that working as an architect for a property developer in this city, it's about, historically, it's been about being a part of a machine that's about delivering product for profit, not about delivering quality, sustainable housing outcomes. And I think for us, when we started work, you know, on the Commons, it was a decision for us to say, let's try and build a pilot prototype that we could then bring all of our developer clients through and say, there is something better that we can do, something that is sustainable, that does build community, that people actually want to live in. And that, you know, potentially they can still make money off it. Wouldn't that be good? And then we could do that instead. But I think the issue for us with the Commons was that it actually didn't lead to market change. We opened it up We had, you know, Open Houses Melbourne, you know, had brought over 1,000 people through in one day. Robin Boyd opened it up for a day. We had lots and lots of tours, lots of people coming through, lots of developers, and we just didn't see much change, which is why we had to start Nightingale.
So I really want to talk about the commons. I'll just ask you one last question before that, though. You had a successful practice long before potentially the commons or Nightingale was really a twinkle in your eye. So when and how did you first start thinking about, I guess, this idea of a new housing model? Was it that big of an idea at the start, or was it this more kind of gradual idea that came to you through your practice?
There's been no genius at Breathe. It's been, you know, a constant iteration, and I guess a constant goal to try and be better each time we do something. And so the commons, you know, I think it was a one-off for us, and we made a decision early that we would share our IP around it, but it was really hard. We started in 2007. The GFC hit us like a truck in 2009. We lost our bank finance. You know, Tam and I nearly went broke through the whole process. We got Small Giants, fortunately, bailed us out and bought the project office and finished the project. So, yeah, look, for us, I'd love to say that we were thought about this. We planned it out for it, and it's been a long 20-year plan, and it hasn't. It's been, you know, year by year trying to make it better as we go along.
That's really interesting. So you've been pretty transparent about the challenges you faced with the commons as a kind of prototype for this idea. What did you learn from that project that then propelled Nightingale?
Yeah, the big thing for us was that we thought that the future of the city, that housing problems, that affordability could be answered through design. And what we actually found out was that the answer was in finance, and that our financial model was wrong in the commons, and that we changed it for Nightingale. And so we took our design minds as architects and instead turned that to the same way that we do as any architects or designers. We go back to first principles. We speak to the professionals. We look at case studies, and we spoke to experts in the field. We did our research. We got to Dr. Andrea Sharam at RMIT, or she was at Swinburne at the time, and we wrote a new feasibility model, which basically talked about democratizing the capital. So taking the developer out of it with the one bag man with all the money, and democratizing it across 20 or 30 individuals that cared as much about the outcome as we did. And so, you know, I think that it's actually form follows finance.
It's such an interesting learning, and I guess a pretty humbling learning too, because, yeah, you've got to take your ego out of it really, and, yeah, it's got to become a very collaborative process. For anyone who doesn't know, and I doubt there are many people in the room, but for the benefit of anyone who doesn't, could you give us just a brief explanation of the concept behind Nightingale?
Yeah, look, fundamentally, Nightingale is a triple bottom line housing model. The idea is that we have to build sustainably, otherwise there's no point building. So all of our buildings are carbon neutral. We have to build community, otherwise we'll continue to be isolated and we'll have this continuing societal issues. So we limit our apartment numbers to 40, and we design our building to help instigate chance interactions. Seats in the entryway, a seat by the front door, a cafe by home one, 100% social enterprise that's not for profit. Is Dan Poole here tonight? Dan Poole, can you stand up for a minute, Dan? Everyone, this is the Young Victorian of the Year, Dan Poole. When we built Nightingale One, we looked for the right tenant downstairs that would help build community. And so we met Dan Poole. He runs an organisation called Crepes for Change, an organisation called Coffee Cart for Change. And they were looking at how do they get into building a bricks and mortar proposition. And so we helped them. Breathe Architecture did the design for them. We got a builder, Switchco, that built the building for them. And then we got an impact investor to buy that front 12 square meters. These guys opened up this 12 square meter hole in the wall cafe. 100% of their profit goes to help youth homeless. They're incredible. They're this kind of great interface with the street. Anyway, those sort of things, you know, help us build community. I'm on a tangent, aren't I?
Anyway, love the tangent.
Dan Poole's taking me off on a tangent. Thanks for coming, Dan. And then I guess the last thing is about affordability. So are anyone here like trying to buy their first home? Can I see your hands, please? Yeah. Okay. You got any plan on how to do that? So not since 1947 have we had more renters than homeowners in this country. So Australia used to be this place, this equitable place where everyone had an opportunity for housing. Everyone had an access to housing. And what's happened is that if you didn't get on the monopoly board early enough, if your parents aren't wealthy, if you're not middle class, if you can't go to the bank of mum and dad, you have no chance to access housing in Melbourne or Sydney currently. And then we've got a state government that's given over its housing responsibility to the private sector, and the private sector have lobbied the state government saying that the answer to housing affordability is the first law of economics, which is supply and demand. We'll provide more supply, therefore the price will go down. Has that happened in the last 27 years? No. Has wage growth gone up? How can you buy a house when it's now? So for me, when I bought a house, it was four times my salary. When my dad bought his house, it was two times his salary. But for you guys in Melbourne, it's eight times your salary. How is that possible? So we're very interested in how do we provide access for housing for people that need it the most. And so Dan Poole and his organisation works with Launch Housing, and they park their ambulances at the bottom of the cliff, the people that need housing immediately, that can't afford to rent in the open market. Nightingale parks its ambulance at the top of the cliff, and we're trying to stop millennials falling down there. We're trying to stop people that need to downsize into something more affordable down there. And so fundamentally, Nightingale is a housing at cost model. We try to build carbon neutral housing that's meaningful that people would like to live in, and we try to build it as smartly as possible. So we take out all the middlemen. We take out the real estate agents, the marketing team. We don't build a display suite. We ask people what they need. Do you need a car space for $45,000? No, because you don't have a license. Okay, we won't build that for you then. Do you need a second bathroom at $9,000? We can give it to you, but we've got to make your living room 6 or 7 square meters smaller. Do you need air conditioning? If your building is actually double or triple glazed and it's well insulated and well orientated and the glazing is shaded, we do all of these things, and then we deliver housing in Nightingale 1 at about 19% under market. So what that meant was that the bank valuations on Nightingale 1 apartments were coming back at about $95,000 more than our residents paid for them. And then we try to protect that affordability through a restrictive covenant, which runs with the land for 20 years, which means that if we're selling someone an apartment for $100,000 under market, then they can't just make $100,000 tomorrow. Instead, their apartment price goes up with the price of housing in Brunswick over the next 20 years. So it doesn't just jump up, it goes up slowly over time. So that's our kind of, that's us at Breathe Architecture and then at Nightingale Housing trying to hack together some simple hack on the current housing system.
A big part of that, as you kind of alluded to just then, was this idea of housing not being treated really as a commodity and it not being about, I guess, a property investment. So have you seen much pushback on that model? Obviously, you're excluding big players from that conversation. Property developers, marketers, media potentially. I mean, I feel like everyone's so excited about Nightingale, but have you seen anyone really, I guess, have a negative response to that concept and that model?
Yeah. So Nightingale has had a 100% hit rate at VCAT, so the Victorian Civil Appeals Tribunal. So Nightingale 1 was taken to VCAT by the neighbour next door because we didn't have any cars. And we had our planning permit. We'd sold the apartments. We had a building contract signed. We were ready to start. And then we got our permit taken away from us at VCAT because the tribunal member found it impossible to believe that people in the 21st century living next to a bike path, train station, bus line, and tram line could possibly live without a car, you know, because in his way of thinking, it was offensive, you know, that we would even consider that. And when you read the planning scheme, at the front of the planning scheme, it talks about what the aspirational things. The planning scheme talks about sustainable transport, talks about walkable cities. And then in like page 352, it talks about a car park ratio. But what everyone focuses on is page 352 car parking ratio, which was developed by Dallas Department of Transport and Infrastructure in 1966. And we've been kind of like slowly kind of, you know, twiddling at the edges ever since. Are people threatened by us proposing to sell better apartments designed by the city's best architects more affordably? I would imagine, Lucy. I think the thing is that we're very, very small in scale. So, you know, for the big players, I think at the moment they see us as a blip on the radar. We have seen developers like Milieu and PDS come to Breathe Architecture saying, can you design something, please, that's fossil fuel free, that's carbon neutral in operations, that fosters community, you know, that's livable, but we're just going to sell it at market prices. And we say, yes, absolutely, because there is a sector of the market that wants all of those things and doesn't want to wait on a waiting list. So we think that we're really happy about those developers coming to us to have that done, because we think that Nightingale just needs to exist long enough to affect market change. And once everyone else comes to drink the Kool-Aid with us, then I can go back being an architect and talk about beautiful stairs, you know, and all those great things, great bathroom details. And I won't have to spend so much time in meetings with banks trying to convince them that it's not risky to lend money on a project like this.
Nightingale recently won 3 major awards at the Victorian Architecture Awards. Congratulations. I'm really interested. We were just talking about the Melbourne Award. Would you mind letting everyone know what that particular award is about that you won?
Yeah, so we won the Sustainability Award, and which I'm incredibly happy about. Like, that's the one I was really stressed about. Because I think that, you know, if Fairley Batch, our project architect, was here tonight, you would see the look of relief on her face. So she went to like 132 meetings to work through how to build our very own embedded network system so that our residents could get green power cheaper than everyone else pays for black power. It sounds impossible, but she did it. So it's incredibly important, that the Sustainability Award. We won the Multi-Residential Award because, you know, we entered into that category. It's a multi-residential building, so that's good. But the Melbourne Prize, what I love about the Melbourne Prize is that the Institute of Architects has a kind of roaming jury which goes and looks through all 238 entries this year, or, you know, that's about 238 entries. And they look at the projects that they think had an impact on the city of Melbourne. So what sort of positive impact did it have on the city? And normally it goes to schools, libraries, civic buildings. And we were joint winners this year with the new academic building by Lyons, and as a cast of thousands of architects, which is a great building. But we felt incredibly privileged at Breathe and at Nightingale to have Nightingale One recognised as a kind of a building of that significance in the back blocks of Brunswick, you know, that it was significant to Melbourne. Obviously not because of the building, but because of what it stood for.
Yeah, it's a fantastic accolade, and I am so, so glad that you guys were kind of on the radar for that. Now, aside from people that feel threatened, in your words, by the ideas behind Nightingale, Nightingale has also gathered incredible support. It's support from within the design industry, from buyers mainly, because you've got an epically long waiting list to buy these apartments despite having no marketing team. Has that enthusiasm surprised you, or what's been your response to that? Did you ever imagine that there would be this hype around Nightingale?
Not at all. I think that, you know, Bonnie, when we first started getting emails, after we finished the Commons, we were totally burnt out. We had to send Bonnie to Japan for 5 weeks to chill out. And then we started getting emails saying, oh, can you build another one of those? And we were just like trashing them, saying, no, we're not doing that ever again. And then we had about, I think once I got over 10, we got to 11 and we said, oh, maybe we should try again. I think Bonnie was back from Japan. She was rested. I think Tam, we were out of trouble with the bank. I think that it was okay. And so we decided to start again. Yeah, so anyway, we started again. And so we started with just 11 people on that waiting list. And we tried to do the German Baugruppe or the Baugruppen model, where you would gather all the residents early and use their deposits as equity. And we went to the bank and they said, absolutely no. Anyway, I said, no, I won't bore you with the complexity of the Land Act and, you know, how difficult it is to get finance. But it's easy when you've got heaps of money. It's very difficult when you don't have much money. But anyway, we went and met with Dr. Andrea Sharam from Swinburne, and that's when we worked up the Nightingale model. And we sent out this email to 30 architects in Melbourne and said, you know, the state of our city is in it. It's being destroyed under this kind of profit-driven model. We need to stand together to do something. So I'm going to ask you all to put $100,000 towards Breathe Architecture's next project. And this is why. And I described the Nightingale model to them. Two architects, Andrew Maynard from Austin Maynard Architects and Simon O'Brien from Six Degrees Architects, wrote back to me within a minute and said, we're in. Interestingly, both of them said, we'll put in $100,000. And then Andrew wrote back and said, we'll put in $200,000. And then his partner, Kylie, wrote straight back and said, no, we won't. And Simon O'Brien wrote back to me, totally unbeknownst to Andrew, saying, we'll put in $100,000. We'll put in $200,000. And then his partner, Barb, wrote back saying, no, we won't. But then Claire Cousins, Anthony Martin, a young firm by the name of Architecture, two young guys starting out, you know, like it was a massive risk for those guys. Like they barely had the capital. So it was mainly Gen X people leveraging, borrowing against their own homes So Gen X architects backing their competitor to build a home. Like, it was incredible, right? So all these architects backed me, and I said, if I can actually make this work, I'll come back and I'll back you, you know. So anyway, we actually then decided, so Tam and I, we had an apartment in the Commons. And so to show everyone that we were so confident that it would work, and by the way, we weren't confident that it was going to work at the time, but to show everyone was so confident, we bought five shares. So we put in $500,000. Our apartment was worth $580,000. So we literally bet the house on Nightingale One. But when we did that, and then when Six Degrees started Nightingale Two, we didn't have any money left in. So I said, oh, Tam, we've got to put our superannuation into Nightingale Two. So we put our superannuation into Nightingale Two. And then when Austin Maynard starting on Nightingale Three, we didn't have any money and any superannuation. So then Breathe Architecture, we said, okay, well, we'll work for Austin Maynard. And so then Breathe Architecture worked on Austin Maynard for a year to pay for, you know, like whatever it was, a half share in Nightingale Three to help those guys. And then when Claire Cousins started hers, we had nothing left. And we said, sorry, Claire, we can't help you. But the incredible thing was that, so the architecture community backed us, which was incredible. Like, it was so touching. And then beyond that, you know, our 11 residents grew to 57, I think, when we had like the first kind of information night. And then we had a ballot, and our residents were incredible. So our residents walked through the Commons. We had all the meetings in our apartment. The mayor of Moreland drew their names out of the hard hat. So we had the ballot, you know, 57 names came down to 20. They all signed their contracts of sale. You know, we told them that we're going to put this restrictive covenant on. They're incredibly supportive all the way through, and they trusted us. When we lost our permit, we called them in and we said, look, we're really sorry. We thought we could do this and we can't, clearly. And so we gave them back their deposit checks and their contracts and said, okay, you know, look, we'll tear up the contracts. And 18 of 20 of them said, no, we're going to stay. And so they stayed for another 12 months for us to get another permit. It was incredible. So the residents totally backed us all the way through. And then beyond that, yeah, I mean, Dan Varco from Fisher Paykel is here tonight. So then we had people like Dan turning up saying, look, I work for an appliance company. You know, we've got a marketing budget. What can we do to help you? And we're like, well, we need to establish Nightingale Housing. We need to buy a website. We need to manage this database. I need to employ someone to talk to these people that are emailing us. And I need cheap appliances, Dan. And so Fisher Paykel came on board with their kind of sustainable Nightingale pack and came and helped us. Yeah, so, I mean, it's been incredible, the support. Melbourne University have supported us. People like, you know, Dan Poole coming to find a way to come into buildings like us because they trust us. So, no, look, I mean, it's been incredible. And then finally, banks actually starting to give us money, you know, and that's been a challenge. But, you know, here we are.
Are you making a documentary about this? Because you should be. Is someone filming this?
I've met lots of documentary filmmakers. So there have been three documentaries started on this.
Have you got the footage?
No, but they finish.
We'll talk later.
They just start and they take, you know, it's lots of footage and then they just disappear. So I think it gets a bit dry when you realize the project actually takes 4 years. You know, it's awesome for the first 2 months and it's like, oh, no.
Can you tell us a little bit about Nightingale Village? And I guess thinking about these architects that have all come along for the ride, the way that Nightingale Village is bringing all these different architects together.
Yeah, so I think that the interesting thing is that the idea of Nightingale, you know, one of its pillars being community, the Commons works really well to build community within its own building, and it's done that incredibly well. And Tam and I live there and it's been great. But when Nightingale One came, what we saw was this change in the way that the street worked, and it happened almost immediately. So Nightingale One gets built. Underneath the Commons, we've got Steam Junkies. I didn't name it. It's a cafe. It's called Steam Junkies. And then next to that is Brad's Wine Shop. And then across the road, Branch Studio Architects come in, and they've got staff coming in and out, and they're cool, and they've got a little kid, and they live upstairs in Nightingale One. And then Home One come downstairs, and then the residents of Nightingale and the Commons go and advocate at the local council to close the street and turn it into a park. The council put in pocket parks on both sides of the street, and there's all this life on the street, kids, dogs. And it's just if anyone's been to the Commons, like, it is in the middle of dirty Brunswick. Like, it is not a great place. But there's this great kind of, you know, life on the street. And so it became abundantly clear to us that the space between those buildings and what happens there, the life on the street, that's where the communities actually come together and they do something more. They interact with the rest of the community. And so there was this site for sale two streets south of the Commons for ages, and Rod, he'd bought it in the 80s for like, I don't know, $200,000, and then he wanted to sell, you know, these 11 sites for $20 million. And they had this permit on it, which Breathe Architecture Crew referred to as the snake turd because it was terrible. And we were, you know, Dan and I were like ran a million kind of dream feasibilities on it saying, you know, what else could this be? There was like $9 million worth of car park underneath it, like 160 cars over two levels underneath this whole thing. And we're just going, what a waste. Anyway, I don't know what happened one day. I woke up and I convinced Tam that perhaps we should buy that site. Is this being recorded?
Yes, it is being recorded.
Okay, come and talk to me later. I'll tell you how we bought the site. But fundamentally, we spoke to Claire Cousins, Kennedy Nolan, Architecture, Austin Maynard Architects, even a big firm like Habel, and a really young firm called Wawawa. And by the way, like Wawawa came in, and I'll tell you about Mon later. She's incredible. But so we spoke to six other architects and we said, we want to buy this site. So we thought we could buy it for $17 million. We ended up paying $18.5 million, which I don't know about you, but that makes me feel incredibly uncomfortable. And so that's why you should talk to me later about how we bought it, but it was challenging to say the least. It took us about 9 months to buy the site off Rod because, as it turns out, Rod didn't really want to sell the site because he was still driving a forklift there. He'd had it forever, didn't really want to give it up, so it was very challenging. But the idea for us was that if we could buy sites on both sides of the street, build seven buildings by seven architects, building seven bespoke communities that could all come out in the street, and we could start to make urban design decisions that other developers perhaps wouldn't, like let's take all the cars off the street. Let's put in go get car share hub of 20 cars. Let's make them all electric vehicles. Let's put in 240 bikes in a consolidated bike park with end-of-trip facilities. Let's put in some place to charge electric bikes and to put cargo bikes and the big bikes that are probably going to come in the future. Let's think about the tenants like Home One that can come in, you know, downstairs and engage in the street. And then let's start interviewing our Nightingale waitlist so that we can start to house them meaningfully. Anyway, so that's kind of, you know, the process. It sounds really easy.
No, it doesn't.
But to get seven architects to buy that site, what it meant was that we all had to cross-collateralize each other. It means we all had to take risk on that $18.5 million site. So we weren't just buying a $3 million site each. You know, we were buying $18.5 million. So it was incredible that Claire and Rachel and Andrew and Mon all came and stood beside me and said, look, we're prepared to take this risk with you. We believe in this and we're going to help make it happen. So, yeah, it's incredible. So, well, it's an incredible idea. Like, let's talk about it in early 2021 to see if it is incredible or not. I hope it will be incredible.
It will be incredible. You talk a lot about taking risks when it comes to Nightingale and kind of managing those risks. Can you describe, I guess, your approach to risk taking? Are you just like this brave guy that goes, stuff it, let's just do it? Like, do you get really nitty gritty with risk analysis, I guess, or are you very intuitive in the way you approach financial risk and other risks? What kind of chuckling is going on in the corner there?
Sorry. So Tamara handles financial risk and Bonnie handles every other type of risk. And so for me, risk is, if you actually boil what risk down it is, if you boil it down, everyone sees risk through one simple lens, which is financial loss. It's all about money. So if you value money more than anything, then you don't want to take any risks. You want to protect that. If you think that not building a more sustainable city is a risk, which I think it is, if you think not strengthening community is a risk, which I think it is, then I feel like, you know, as a practice, we have no other choice. We have to do this. So it's all about, I think it's just the lens that Nightingale and Breathe looks through. It's just money, Lucy.
That is the best answer to that question. Thank you. So what would the ultimate, I guess, sustainable future Melbourne look like to you? What is the end game of all this in your eyes?
Well, I think that the one thing I'm sure of is that I have no idea what the end game is. You know, I keep on thinking that I can see the future, but I can't. Maybe I can see 5 years ahead, but, you know, if we think that in 20 years' time no one's going to own their own car and everyone will be driving in autonomous vehicles, if we think that in 35 years, you know, we'll be in unmanned drones, you know, flying around, like, you know, does that mean that our public transport system doesn't work anymore? What does that mean? Like, I think that the big thing for me is that from a sustainability point of view, if you think about us as a herd animal, if you think about a city as an opportunity for us to come together, collaborate, share ideas, make ourselves better, demand better of each other. Like, cities are incredibly important, which is why we all live in a city. It's why we choose to be here. So I don't think that that's ever going to change. I think we're always going to be in cities. But I think for me, the future looks not like a grid of asphalt with buildings stuck in between. Like, I think this is going to be irrelevant in the future. In the near future, it's not going to be, we just won't own our own cars. So we're going to have lots of car parks to put mushroom farms in or nightclubs or something. But I think that the thing for me is about this really simple idea about the walkable village, that you can have true mixed-use buildings, so not just residential towers with a car park at the bottom, but, you know, places for people to work, live, places where we can actually try and protect the arts so that, you know, all those poor artists in Brunswick just don't keep on getting – they've already been pushed out of Fitzroy to go to Brunswick. Where are they going to end up next? Like, how do we find ways to protect those cultural assets that keep on getting pushed out? Yeah, so I guess the future for me, it does look greener. Look greener, literally greener, like as in vegetated. It looks greener as in carbon neutral as the cost of that, you know, technology comes down all the time. I think I'm very, very hopeful for that. And I'd like to think that it looks more collaborative.
And so do you think we can reimagine that kind of great Australian dream to align with that sort of future?
I think great Australian dream for me, it doesn't ring true for me, because I think that, you know, when I think of the great Australian dream, you know, I think of my big house, my big car, my big dog, my big fence, my big fridge, my spare fridge out the back with my drinks in it. So I think that perhaps the future is, you know, the great global dream.
So I guess Nightingale is a big part of shifting what Australians want, right? Like, is that part of the mission too? Like, you want people to change what their aspirations are, I guess.
I don't want anyone to do, like, we live in a democracy, right? I mean, I'd love to be a benevolent dictator, but we live in a democracy. And I think that all that Nightingale does is that we think that we provide a housing option for people that actually want that. So I don't think that we don't want to build something and then market to someone and tell them this is what they want. I think if there's 5,200 people on a waiting list, I think that all we're doing is trying to, there's this latent demand, because there are many people here that have been on a plane and have been to Europe. They've seen a 19 square meter apartment in Paris. They've seen how beautiful that could be. They've been in a 40 square meter apartment in New York and they know how that works. And I'm not saying that none of our apartments are that size currently, but we're working on a new model of housing looking like at the pocket living in London or like the micro apartments in New York. In Nightingale Village, we've got these tile house apartments. It's German for part of house. They're as small as 29 square meters and they're designed incredibly well. They've got a, you know, fold down bed, lots of joinery. They've got a kitchen and a bathroom, a living area. But on the roof of this particular building in Nightingale Village, there's a bathhouse, there's, you know, all this stuff, right? There's an Airbnb, and the Airbnb, your family and friends can come and stay in. So the idea is that the whole building works as your house. And so the tile house is just part of your house. Anyway, we're looking like we can sell those. And to be totally honest, we're cross-subsidizing them with the bigger apartments. So if you're here buying a big apartment in Sky House in Nightingale Village, sorry to say this, but we're charging you slightly higher per square meter because you're probably downsizing. You know, you bought a house 20 years ago and you can afford to cross-subsidize some millennial trying to get into the housing market to get some housing security. So those tile house apartments are starting at $200,000 each. The loan repayments on that are about $200 a week or just under. And you can rent a bedroom in a shitty share house in Brunswick for $200 and it'll leak and it'll be freezing in winter, boiling in summer. And you'll have some guy that'll leave his stuff all over the lounge room. So anyway, so I guess we think that there's an opportunity to deliver other European models of housing, because we think that everyone in Australia is, well, not everyone, but some people in Australia are ready for that.
Yeah, by the look of your wait list, I would agree with you. I'm going to ask you one more question and then we'll open up to the room. So what's next for Nightingale? You've said before that Nightingale, there doesn't need to be necessarily more Nightingales, but that you're hoping that the model inspires, you know, this kind of development, you know, even from for-profit developers, for instance. What's next in your eyes? Beyond Nightingale Village, what is the next challenge?
Can I just offer a correction too? So Nightingale established itself as a not-for-profit, and we spent 2 years trying to get charitable status and DGR status. Former CEO Jesse Hochberg flew all around the country trying to secure government land so that we could do this and deliver housing cheaper. After 2 years, we never got one piece of land. We got some nice certificates from governments. Congratulations, good job, keep it up. And we didn't get charitable status or DGR status because it's said that we give private benefit to the residents that live in the building at the end. So we're changing the structure at Nightingale, profit for purpose. We're working with some superannuation companies, some member-based superannuation companies. And what we're looking to do currently is to move into long-term affordable rental. Still to do Nightingale, but we think that if you think about Sydney, for example, we don't know how to fix the problem in Sydney. The land is so expensive. You know, if we're buying land in Melbourne at, say, $85,000 per apartment. So before we start work on anything, just by buying that land at $18.5 million, every apartment is $85,000 on the day we buy that site. In Sydney, it's $210,000. So it doesn't matter. By the time if we hold that site for 4 years, because it's a long DA process in Sydney, and we pay the cost of capital at 15% per annum to hold that, you know, over 4 years, it's $300,000 just for the land. So we have to find a different way to try and solve the problem in Sydney. So we think we're too late in Sydney, basically. We think we're maybe just in time in Melbourne. But so we're looking at kind of different models, you know. So smaller apartments, tile house apartments, can we do long-term affordable rental? So we're looking at all these things. We don't know when we'll get there, but we'll just keep on trying.
I'm so inspired by everything you're saying. I could ask you a million more questions, but I'm sure there's burning questions in the audience. So I might open it up now so we've got time for a few questions, if anyone has any.
I've got a lot of questions, but I'm sure other people ask some of them. But one of my questions would be, you say you've got such a long waiting list. What's the demographic of that list? Are they all kind of like your Brunswick kind of type of alternatives, or are you getting interest from like other suburbs, like eastern suburbs or Bayside suburbs, that sort of thing?
Yeah, no, really good question. So I think there's two questions in that. So one is, what's our demographic, and is it, are we moving east or south? Have I got that right?
Who's the demographic?
Yeah, okay. So look, you don't have to have a long beard and tats to live in a Nightingale apartment. And I know that seems like, you know, 9 of our 12 Nightingale projects are happening in Brunswick at the moment, and it is for a certain reason. So we're buying land in Brunswick at about $3,000 or $4,000 a square metre, you know, at that rate that I was talking about before. We've got a council in the city of Moreland, a progressive council that cares deeply about sustainability. They've got an affordable housing task force. So we've got support at both the officer level and at the political level, which is unusual. Often you'll have support at kind of the officer level, but not at the political level, or at the political level, not at the officer level. So it makes it the right political environment for us to operate in, particularly if we're looking at things like smaller apartments or car-free developments, you know, things like that. The commons, the early adopters in the commons, the first person to ever buy one of our apartments is Ursula. She's 65. She's a downsizer from the Blue Mountains. And then it's like Marianne, who's nearly 60 at the time, Susan, who's 72, again, a downsizer wanting to be near her family. So the commons, the early adopters were baby boomers downsizing, wanting a sense, actually wanting safety, security, community, sustainability. They were the things that they wanted. With Nightingale One, I think that we'd had a bit of press off the commons. And the interesting thing about Nightingale One is that it was nearly all millennials interested in Nightingale One. So 85% of purchases at Nightingale 1 are first-time buyers aged under 35. Nightingale 2, it's kind of got a broader spread. So Gen X is, it's in Fairfield, it's a little bit further out, a little bit more expensive because it's a island site with light and ventilation on four sides. It's a beautiful site, very challenging for a number of reasons, but beautiful site. Nightingale 3, Gen Millennials and Gen Xers. But Nightingale Brunswick East is further south. It's closer to the park. It's closer to the city. It's slightly more expensive. We partnered with Lucent Capital, so they're a development company. And in that instance, the apartments were bigger. And incredibly, in that instance, it was mainly baby boomers downsizing in there. So we saw kind of a big flip, you know, in the size of apartments, the price of apartments and the demographic. What's consistent across all of our projects is we have more females buying our apartments than males. So in the commons, it's like 65% females. In Nightingale 1, it's like 72% females. historically all of our same-sex part residents have been females. We've only just got our first same-sex males in the Commons as renters. So it's interesting to see, I think, that females see these buildings as a home, whereas I think that guys think of it as an investment or something like that, or guys can't live without cars or something. I haven't been able to understand exactly why that's been the case. Everyone is welcome. I think if I speak personally, you know, I would like that everyone that came to buildings like the Commons and Nightingale, that they would all, you know, everyone would have a community spirit, that they would treat each other with respect, that they would be engaged and take personal responsibility for the building and its surrounds. You know, that were the things that I would ask, and I don't think that's specific to Brunswick people. So we're seeing people coming from all over for different reasons. The reason that we haven't gone east or south has been both political and also financial. So the cost of land when we go south the river increases. So it kind of affects the affordability pillar for us. We'll get there.
Have you had regional models at all? Have you, like, in terms of the cost of land, obviously it's cheaper, Castlemaine or Bendigo or that sort of thing. Have you looked at that type of place?
Yeah, so the question is, have we looked at regional models? And, yeah, absolutely. So we've had a co-housing group approaches from Wangaratta, so kind of a seniors co-housing group wanting to build a Nightingale together, wanting to downsize from big, leaky houses into something that builds community and is sustainable and is comfortable. We've had Austin Maynard looking at a Nightingale in Bendigo, and Dan can probably fill you in about that. So there's challenges working in regional places that we haven't been able to crack yet. So the issue for us is that while the land is cheaper, the build cost stays the same for us. So when you build a carbon neutral building, our heat pump costs $100,000. It's not $15,000 for a gas-fired boiler. You know, our double and triple glazing costs three times the amount of anyone else's windows. So what we find is that we can't bring down the cost of building. And so when we go to somewhere like Bendigo, for example, or Castlemaine, they're generally very car-centric, those places. Most people have cars, and they can drive 5 minutes out of the CBD or from the train station and be on 5 acres, you know, on a house. And so for us to go there, it's incredibly challenging. Not only, I'm sure we could find people to buy there, but the issue is that the banks then send out their valuers, and their valuers see something that's never existed there before. And they say, we don't know how to value this. Every other flat that's here was built in 1972. It's falling apart, and it's valued at $5,000 a square meter. So although it's cost us, you know, whatever it is, $8,000 a square meter to build it, the valuers are only valuing it at $5,000 a square meter. So when you go to settle on your mortgage, the bank says your property is worth $150,000 less than what you paid for it, and you've got a massive problem. So we haven't been able to crack that nut yet, but I think Maynard's trying pretty hard in Bendigo at the moment to make that work.
Can I ask why the covenant only lasts for 20 years? Why do you not keep the covenant on it permanently, or whatever you do with covenants? I'm not sure.
So the covenant, one of my members on the board, we've got a board, and one of my members hates the covenant. A lot of people, you know, hate the covenant. There's lots of covenant hating. That's okay. Don't buy into Nightingale. But so I wanted the covenant to run in perpetuity. And we got a lot of advice around the covenant when we were writing it, and we haven't seen one in Australia work like this before. And the question was, at what point does the market distort or change where the covenant becomes nonsensical? So I think that if we looked at, you know, Nightingale 1, for example, so in 20 years' time, you know, if it's linked to the price of housing over time, in 20 years' time, does the building need a lift upgrade? Does it need a fire services upgrade? And at that point in time, would there be a whole lot of other Nightingales coming into the market? I know it's weird because, you know, what happens in year 19 when you want to sell your house? Would you sell it, or would you actually just, you know, hold it for next year? So it is really imperfect, and we don't really know how that's going to work over time. I guess when I said that I wanted the covenant to run for 20 years, everyone thought it was crazy. They should run for 5. But I think that the issue for us is that, you know, there's a lot of people in this room from Breathe and from Nightingale that have taken – Jason sitting over here is our in-house legal counsel. So Jason works at Mallesons, and he volunteers with Nightingale Housing 2 days a week. He doesn't even get paid. You know, so we've got people like that working because they care about the city. And so if we're going to sell something at $100,000 or $150,000 under market, I would hate to think that someone could then flip that and sell that tomorrow and make that money, so that then someone else tries to get into the housing market and they can't. So Yeah, I think that, you know, the Covenant is one small attempt at trying to keep that affordability running for more than just, you know, the first purchases.
I'm trying to understand how you've obviously invested a lot of time and money in your model. If you want to spread it, I live in the Bayside and there's a lot of development along the railway line. How do we get, say you don't want to buy there, but someone else does, some developer but wants to use your model. How are you going to share that intellectual property so we do get it spread around Melbourne to other parts that perhaps don't suit you? You get the benefit, but we all get the benefit in other places.
Yeah, look, I guess it's not about what suits me. I think it's about us trying to, because you've got to understand that we have a very, very small team. So most of these crew here at Breathe, Nightingale is 3 full-time staff and 2 part-timers and 1 ragtag volunteer. But I think that the issue for us is where do we expend our energy? Where do we have the most impact? And so at the moment we're relatively under-resourced. We're just running from – we run a pretty lean balance sheet at Nightingale Housing currently. So I think that the answer to that question would be if someone came to us, like there's a group that's talking to us at the moment that has a group of children with intellectual disabilities, and so there's 5 of them, and so they would like to live in the eastern suburbs. So they're looking to form a group, like a co-housing group, to buy a particular site, and then we would work with them. So the easy answer is if land price is a problem for us, because it exposes us to risk to build something that we think is expensive for the people that we think need help with housing the most. I think that maybe in the Bayside suburbs, if people choose to live there because they can afford to, maybe is the answer to that, that yeah, that's right, that we do share our IP with developers, and we're happy to do that. We've worked with Lucent Capital before. That's Nightingale Brunswick East. We've worked with Milieu. We've worked with PDS. So we would be happy to do that. I think that a lot of developers find us a little bit challenging around our demands. So we demand that any project that we're working on, whatever it is, the entire precinct has to be carbon neutral. And we don't think it's that hard, but they find that a challenge because, you know, they can't put a wok burner in. So there's, you know, half of the Antarctic ice sheet peeling off, but we want to burn gas because our residents want gas to the building. So I think it's interesting, right, because they see not having a wok burner as a risk to their sales rather than saying there is a bigger issue that we need to all stand behind.
Well, I think it is that thing of like outcomes. They are looking for one outcome and it's a financial outcome and it's, you know, it's a profit-driven model, which, yeah, I guess that's where you're not quite seeing eye to eye because Nightingale's about much more than that. Another question or two before we close?
It's not a question. I actually would like to just say how inspired I've been by your work over the years. And I'll draw Mercedes into this. My dad was a massive Mercedes fan. He had several over the years. He had a terrible stroke about 4 years ago, and his favourite shop in Nepean Highway, on Nepean Highway, was Mercedes Brighton, and they became like family to us. They looked after him and they stopped him buying rocket ships that he could never have driven. They were absolutely amazing people. When he passed away, we did inherit the proceeds of his Mercedes and a house and bought 2 apartments at Little Miller, which I am passing on to his grandsons.
So the context of Little Miller is that's the developer Lucent Capital partnered with Nightingale Housing. So they were going to build 65 apartments and they were going to sell them on the open market. And they came and spoke to Breathe Architecture about saying, would you do the interiors for us? And we said, no, sorry. And they said, but if we could split your building in half, do half of it as Nightingale, we'll do the sustainability kind of strategy for your entire building. And we'll do the interiors for both buildings. You can sell half as straight-to-market apartments, which is Little Miller, and then sell half as Nightingale apartments. And then you won't have to worry about, you know, building a display suite for that half of the building. You'll just sell it all through the ballot process. And you'll be able to get your construction finance sooner. You won't have to wait for 6 months to get your pre-sales, and you'll save all this money in holding costs, which will offset the reduced cost of the housing in Nightingale, Brunswick East. And so Little Miller, the apartments that you bought, the carbon neutral, you know, straight to market, which basically it looks exactly the same as Nightingale, except that it's straight to market. So well done.
To keep up with Jeremy's award-winning architectural practice and his incredible team, you can follow Breathe Architecture on Instagram at Breathe Architecture. That's B-R-E-A-T-H-E Architecture. You can also keep up to date with Nightingale Housing and all of their various projects and developments around Melbourne on Instagram at nightingale.housing. We featured an in-depth story on Nightingale One with some stunning photographs of the first apartment building created under the Nightingale model, which residents moved into earlier this year. You can revisit that story via the link in our show notes. Or if you're looking at the enhanced podcast, you'll be seeing some photos right now. We've also included a link to Jeremy's super inspiring 2015 TED Talk in our show notes. It's a few years old now, but well worth a watch. You've been listening to TDF Talks, a podcast from The Design Files, Australia's most popular design blog. This episode is supported by Mercedes Me, a cafe, event space and concept store operated by Mercedes-Benz on the corner of Collins and King Streets in Melbourne. Today's episode was recorded live at Mercedes Me. To keep up to date with all of our events and other events taking place in the venue, you can also follow them on Instagram at mercedesmestore.melbourne. If you're Melbourne-based, there are still a couple of tickets available for our final event next Tuesday, July 31st, featuring comedian, TV and radio personality and passionate advocate for Australian design, Tim Ross. Tickets are $22 and are on sale now at thedesignfiles.eventbrite.com. As always, all the links mentioned today can be found in our show notes at thedesignfiles.net/podcast. You can also visit our main website, thedesignfiles.net, where we post new content 3 times a day, featuring Australian design, art, architecture, and more. Thank you so much for tuning in, and if you've enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe to TDF Talks on iTunes. Thanks for listening.